Welcome to Engage with Andy Bush. In order to stay ahead in business, you need to be on the pulse of the business world, current news, and politics. We'll provide the thought-provoking topics and show you where we have been, what's next, and what it means for you at home. Life's complicated. Let Andy help you figure it out. Now, here is your host, Andy Bush.
Welcome to Engage. This week, we're taking a look at a country that not only won the Olympic gold in hockey, but stayed above, really, the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis. Of course, we're talking about Canada. So our goal today is to review the current state of Canadian politics and the Canadian economy to see what we can learn from a country that balanced its budget for 10 years prior to the financial crisis. Pretty impressive, to say the least. To do this, we first have to have on a woman who has been at the core of reporting on Canada and the world for the Canadian Broadcast Company. Amanda Lang is the co-host of CBC's The Lang and O'Leary Exchange and joins us today from Toronto. Amanda, welcome.
So great to be with you, Andy.
All right. Well, let's rock and roll and let's talk about what are the big political stories for Canadians. And I think the first one that jumps out at me is clearly energy. I mean, there is a lot of trapped oil in the Alberta oil sands. And the big question is how to get the energy out to the rest of the world. The Enbridge Northern Gateway proposal that just received approval from Ottawa, I think that's a great place to start. What's happening there and why?
Yeah, I mean, you're dead right. That is the top political story. And it's raising the same issues that we get when you look beyond our country, which is the bigger picture issue of do you want to have a reliance on fossil fuels? But for now, that's the story of Canada. We are a resource economy. We're pretty similar to Australia. We need to develop it. And as you say, because we're kind of locked in, we can't get our oil out of the oil sands, which is a massive, one of the biggest deposits on the planet, to market. Either in the U.S. or elsewhere, we're now facing this huge discount. It's costing us billions of dollars a year. And so Northern Gateway, which would take the oil from the Alberta oil sands west to British Columbia and then to markets in Asia, is seen as one way to solve that problem. And you're right, the government just said we give it the go-ahead, but there's a long way to go between now and actually seeing a pipeline. And some of the problems are you got to deal with our First Nations. There's lots of Aboriginal communities between Alberta and British Columbia, and they all get a veto. There's the government of British Columbia, which is sort of raising some issues of its own. And then there's huge opposition from environmental groups who, frankly, you know, in some cases, Andy, don't even want us to be using oil at all. So there's still a mountain to climb here, but this was at least a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it seems in the United States, we are dealing with same issues, a little different. We just recently had the EPA come out with their rulings on CO2 emissions that's going to change a lot of the way that we produce electricity in this country over the long term. But for Canada, I mean, I think the difficult thing is to look at the balance between, you know, taking a look at a huge resource for Canada, not only from the sense of exports, but also from job standpoint, and saying, look, you know, this is not the greatest thing for the environment per se, but overall, the net balance is a huge positive for the country, and you have to get it out.
Absolutely. I mean, I think actually, interestingly, for a long time, the U.S. was seen as a laggard on the whole climate change file on kind of carbon reductions. Mm-hmm. What the EPA did could well be a really positive signal to my government, and I hope they're paying attention, because, you know, we do need to develop that resource. We are reliant on it. If you turn off the taps today, we got a bunch of banks, and that's kind of it in this country. So we're not going to do away with the oil. What I would say is the right direction is to say, let's start thinking about carbon taxes or cap and trade mechanisms that say we're still going to do it, but we're starting to get realistic about the global cost, the footprint of it. And then that in turn will fund and fuel innovations, just as we're going to see huge innovations in your country because your coal industry is going to have to figure something out. Is it scrubbers? Is it different, you know, solutions to produce electricity? Mm-hmm. Once you get the regulation in place, then you see business and the creativity of individuals coming out.
Yeah, and certainly that has been the case with the shale boom in the United States, for sure. And, you know, the question I have is, like, would that pipeline, I mean, it clearly addresses the problems that the United States caused for Canada because of the lack of the pass-through of the Keystone Pipeline. Now, that may change down the road, but Canada's not waiting, and I think that's a good idea. That pipeline could create or help create Canada and turn them into really an energy superpower.
Yeah, I mean, one, that the idea is to reduce our reliance on the U.S., and even if it wasn't about Keystone, we wanted that Keystone Pipeline down to Cushing, which is, of course, where we still send the majority of our oil.
Right.
But as you know, shale gas, shale oil means you guys are actually becoming energy independent. It won't last forever, but there's going to be a period of time when your imports fall dramatically. They already have. We need to diversify. Now, we should note there's already a pipeline going east in our country that's been approved, that's being built, and that's actually, you know, it's not ideal. It doesn't get you right to China's doorstep, but it's still a way to get oil out of this country without relying on the American market, because you guys don't need us the way you always did. So as long as people are still using oil, we better get it to market.
Oh, we still need you. Oh, we still need you.
In different ways. I know. I know. For Olympic hockey, because some of our guys go play on your team.
That's right, for sure. Well, no, from an energy standpoint, clearly having a friendly neighbor to the north, unlike the guys in the Middle East, is a very good thing.
Right,
and
yeah.
It's very beneficial. So I think that's important. Well, let's talk about the benefits of the energy sector for the average Canadian. I mean, just give me the top three.
Well, the obvious one is revenues to government. So it's a huge source of federal government revenues. Obviously, the provinces that have this energy, there's huge job creation. So if you just look across our nation, you can see Alberta, Saskatchewan, Newfoundland, the big energy producing provinces, are the ones where you see job boom, job shortages, frankly, in some ways. But for all Canadians, there is a level of innovation, R&D expertise that we develop because of these industries. And that's actually where our government could be a little thoughtful. It's, you know, the old-fashioned view of a resource company is a kind of just a, you know, hewer of wood and a drawer of water. But the fact is they're hugely innovative companies now. They invest massive amounts in R&D, and we should really be capitalizing on that and exporting it globally to other places that have similar kind of technological needs. Meanwhile, we do need, as you alluded, we do need to find a way to say it's great, we have lots of revenue coming from oil and gas, but how do we help that fund a high-tech sector or a biotech sector? Or
right.
Without it being a government-led initiative, you have to find that balance, because at the moment, we really are tilted all towards, really, we're resources and we're financials, and that's not really the great way to sort of create a future for the nation.
Well, it's not stable. That's the problem, right? And that's the thing about the United States. It's the breadth of the economic activity that really helps it, that, you know, we can sustain survive, the 2008 financial crisis. Close, but we did.
Yeah.
And the thing is we can see growth. And, well, one of the things, too, in Canada that is very helpful is the return of the auto sector, and that's been key. Obviously, energy plays a role there, because if energy prices were soaring, you wouldn't probably have that same return of auto sales.
That's right. Although, again, this gets to kind of one of Canada's biggest problems. You know, we did get a global reputation because we survived the credit crisis better. Our banking system was smaller and more closely regulated, and so we were just better prepared for it, and we came through it better. But the fact of the matter is we're not as productive as other nations. And so auto's back. That's been great for us. It's kept some of the manufacturing jobs. And as you know, Canada participated in the bailout of the big three on a kind of a relative basis.
Right,
we did
definitely.
A 10% bailout. We kept jobs here, but they're going, Andy. They're going now to U.S. states, because we can't offer – you guys have, you know, natural gas prices at rock-bottom levels, so a lot of energy costs down there, and a more productive workforce, more flexible workforce. Some of that's anti-union stuff, but some of it's simple productivity, and that's something we do as a nation need to figure out.
Yeah, your country and mine, both. That – takes us right into the next topic, I think, that is compelling, obviously, is youth unemployment in Canada. Similar to the United States, Canada suffers from the young not getting jobs. Why is this happening in Canada, and what's being suggested to resolve the situation?
Well, it's happening for the same reason it's happening everywhere, which is when there's a crunch in the middle. So people aren't retiring because they can't afford it. They lost some of their savings. And therefore, you have this kind of push down. And so young people aren't getting the jobs they used to get. They're just not, the openings aren't there. But it's also happening because some of the jobs that they used to get are disappearing. In some cases, that's to new Canadians. In some cases, that's to mechanization. There was this plan suggested this week by a group called the Broadbent Institute, which is a kind of center left group. And they want not a youth employment strategy, they want a youth employment guarantee. Mm-hmm. So they want every young person coming out of school
a guaranteed
job within 4 months. And they say a combination of private sector and government expenditure on this, not that much actually, but $600 million a year, would achieve this. Now, it sounds in some ways pleasant. You know, if you've got a teenager, you'd say, okay, that's great. He gets a job.
My hand is raised. I would like to.
Exactly. You want to jump in and say, what?
Yeah.
Why are we intervening in the labor market this way? So what I would say, the only piece of this that I would say makes sense to me, and we should be taking a look at, is businesses do not mentor or apprentice or train the way they used to.
Yeah.
It's much easier to go find, some adult somewhere that, whether in our case it's a lot of immigrants that are brought in specifically for jobs, but training young people is a responsibility of business, and businesses do have record levels of cash. So there is a kind of, you could sort of use a moral argument with them. I don't think going to legislation makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. You know, Canada's done some amazing things from the 1990s where you guys righted the ship and cleared the decks and cut government spending and then cut the corporate tax rate. That really encouraged a lot of businesses to grow in Canada, and I think that's fantastic. Even combined with the provincial taxes, I think the corporate tax rate is still below the United States. So
that's right.
So that's a really good thing. And of course, as somebody myself, my training, University of Chicago, we're kind of, you know, we don't like to see the government intervene at all because they do such a terrible job of it. So you have to be a little bit careful. But on the jobs front, one of the things that's happened, you can make the arguments for or against unions, but it's pretty clear that with the decline in the unions, you had a decline also in the apprenticeship programs where businesses were working with unions and you had these programs developed to train the workers. And other CEOs that I've had on my show come on and say the same thing.
Yep.
They need people with certain skill sets that aren't there. So a public-private partnership when it comes to mentoring and it comes to apprenticeships would be a good thing. Without, you know, finding that balance where you're not forcing companies to do something is important, but you do need to get that training.
I agree. When one of the problems that CEOs have pointed out to me is they'd be happy to invest in training their young employees or any of their employees, but employees aren't loyal the way they once were. And so their fear is they make this big investment in somebody and then they lose them a few years later. And that is true. I mean, younger people do have a tendency to kind of move around in a bigger...
You can write contracts for them.
Once you do develop loyalty in your employee when you give them things like training and skills. So I don't know if that's a great argument, but I do know, the imperative to maximize profit means if there's a cheaper way to get that employee, they'll do it. And sometimes there's a cheaper way, and that's what they do. So I guess, is it a tax policy? Is there some kind of incentive? Or is it just kind of public opinion that says, we want to see you big business doing this that helps, move the dial on it?
Well, certainly Starbucks has taken an interesting approach with paying for, online college education. So I think that's an interesting, I don't know if it's the model, but it certainly points a way that could be positive. All right, well, let me shift gears a little bit. Another issue shared by the two countries, obviously, is low economic growth. I mean, the United States this week had us, shockingly discover that growth was not -1%, not -2%, but actually -2.9%. So that's pretty bad. Obviously, we're getting some commentary about this. Former Bank of Canada Governor David Dodge is recommending that Canada embark on infrastructure spending to get things moving. I mean, Canada essentially is running a balanced budget right now. Is there any push to change this, to increase this type of spending?
Well, there isn't by the current government, but as you say, there are some really rational voices, like a former central bank governor saying, look, just because things seem stable right now, it doesn't mean we're out of the woods.
Right.
And to your point, our future rests, including the price of oil, rests on the U.S. economy. If your economy is sluggish, then we are in big trouble. Mm-hmm. And so there's a big call to invest long term. And the argument is pretty simple, right? When interest rates are at these levels, when your borrowing costs will never be cheaper, and when infrastructure requirements are obvious, it's true in many of your U.S. cities, it's true in all of our Canadian cities, there's a huge upgrade of almost every level of infrastructure required, why not do it when you can borrow at these rates?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I'm just, it's amazing, I see Canadian politicians do some really good things, and the U.S. remains so timid on this front, it's kind of astounding to say the least. Well, just in the little bit of time that we have left, since you're right at the core there of what's going on in Canada, what do you think are going to be the top three stories at the end of summer for Canada?
Well, I still think the pipelines are going to dominate because that's going to be something that we sort of see these incremental sort of suggestions on, including Keystone. You sounded like you were ruling it out. I'm not ruling it out. jobs and the economy federally is a huge story. And I think we're going to start to see more kind of interest in what's the plan, folks? Do we need an industrial policy? What are we actually going to do for the future? But I would also say that this whole question of deficit versus stimulus, and there's a couple of big provinces, Ontario and Quebec, who are both wrestling with it in very different ways, and that, I think, is going to be something that gets Canadians going. We all drank the Kool-Aid on getting rid of debt and getting out of deficit, but the debate now, as you say, is it too soon? Do we still need stimulus? And I think that's going to continue to dominate.
Fantastic. Amanda Lang, co-host and chief arm wrestler with Kevin O'Leary. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Andy.
All right. I'm Andy Bush. This is Engage. We'll be right back.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Are you an entrepreneur that wants to achieve more? Not just in it for profit, but to do work you find meaningful, that adds more value to more people in more ways? Listen for Be More, Achieve More, Inspiration for the Entrepreneurial Mind with host Chris Cooper. You'll hear from successful achievers from around the world with a passion and experience to offer invaluable guidance. These people are making a difference and will help give you the motivation and insight to achieve more. Be More, Achieve More can be heard live Fridays at 8 a.m. U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.